Continuing our study tonight from the book of James in chapter 4, and we finished through verse 6 last week, and just to review briefly what we've been studying here in the context of James chapter 4, this being a book written to Christians, yet we see the problems that some of these brethren were having as some of these Christians had gotten caught up in some evil things, and they were having a lot of fighting among themselves. There was a love for the world that they were having a problem with, and as such, as we saw in verse 4, being a friend of the world puts one in the position of being what with God? Well, he says enemy. So this also going back to the latter part of chapter 3, where the contrast between God's wisdom and what is not his wisdom, what is, as he put it in verse 15 of chapter 3, what is not from above but earthly, sensual, devilish. And of course, the devil is the ultimate source of that wisdom that is not from God, and where that wisdom is, where the envying and strife that they were having, he says there is confusion in every evil work in chapter 3, verse 16. And so we see that continue to be dealt with in the beginning of chapter 4, along with that friendship with the world, that love of the world that they were having. So in all of this, that we see elements of that wisdom that is not from God, but is rather from the devil, and that very much is a threat to Christians. Will continue to be. We have to take action against that. Now, the problem that they were having, of course, with being involved in these things and having these parts of that devilish wisdom, was that they were not in good standing with the Lord with that. So there was the very, very plain rebuke that went with that. And so then when we got to verse 6, he turned the focus to what is more hopeful and what can happen instead of facing becoming God's enemy and facing his wrath or punishment. He says that he gives more grace in verse 6. So there is a way to be gaining God's favor, which is what grace is, rather than his anger. Well, that is going to require a different pathway for them to get on than they had been the ones that he was speaking to there or rebuking in the first part of chapter 4. They were going to have to change the direction they were going in as far as those parts of their lives that were against the will of God. So there is this way to gain God's favor, and we can grow in that. Well, he then spelled it out plainly with the second half of verse 6 that we studied where we finished last week. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. So he shows us how we can, rather than receive wrath or punishment from God, instead we can please God and obtain more of his favor. So the question is how? Well, he teaches us that in verse 6, along with also showing us what is the opposite and what will happen then. And we looked extensively at passages in the scriptures from the Old Testament as well as the New Testament where this principle is taught over and over again in God's Word, that he resists the proud. He's going to abase the proud. And he's going to give his grace to whom? He says he gives more grace, and then we would desire that. How do we get more of God's grace, more of his favor? We have to humble ourselves. And now he's going to delve into that more. Now with what we also looked at last week, how do we demonstrate humility? And we spent a good bit of time in those first eight verses of the book of Philippians. Do we need to pause for a moment? Okay. All right. So in Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 8, we see this wisdom of God that we need to have that goes, you know, goes right along with what we saw at the end of James 3. In fact, we looked at that passage in comparison to that too. But what kind of, he says in lowliness, that's humility of mind, humbleness of mind, which is exactly the same word he uses there in verse 6, that God gives grace to the humble. But rather than having vainglory and strife among ourselves, he says that we need to, in lowliness of mind, esteem others better than themselves. Look not also on the things, your own things, but on the things of others. And then that brings us to verse 5, where he says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, as he then shows us that that mind of humility. As we remember, Jesus said, for I am meek and lowly in heart. That's the word for humble. Jesus is humble in heart. And how was that displayed by him? Well, in Philippians 2, 5 through 8, that mind of Christ that we need to have, that humble mind of Christ, where was he? And it shows the extent of his humility. Where did he start? Well, I mean, he was with the Father in the beginning. And in what form? I mean, the Father created all things by him. He was in that divine form of God. What did he do with that? He emptied himself of that and took upon him the form of a servant. He was made in the likeness of men. So he left off all the glory of heaven where he was at his Father's right hand, emptied himself of that, and was made here in this world like us in all things. Now that, how far down is that going from that where he was to what he did to come to this earth? I mean, we're looking forward to one day not being subject to this flesh and having that hope of the resurrection where we're given a glorious eternal spiritual body where we can dwell in eternity with God. Well, Jesus left off the glory he had as God's Son and in the form of God to be made like us. That would be very difficult. It would be impossible, really, to find a way to humble oneself more than that in conjunction with what he did when he was made like us in all things. He came here, was made like us in every way, and as such, as we know from Hebrews 4 and verse 16, that he was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. And what did he do? And how did he show his humility? Well, Philippians 2 and verse 8 says that he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So he didn't come here to be made like us so then he could live his own way. He submitted to his Father in everything, did nothing of himself, did always and only what pleased his Father, and fulfilled all of his will to the point of going to the cross and suffering that horrible death and that crucifixion there when he had done no wrong. He had only done what was right. But he did that. That was his Father's will. And so he humbled himself to do that. So from where he started in the form of God to end up on the cross, I mean, how could there be any greater humility than that? And that is his mind. And he says, let this mind be in you also. So rather than fighting and and warring with each other, or having an affection for this world, all that is to be put away. And we're to humble ourselves as Christ did. And then, as we also spent some time looking at last week in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 19 through 21, what's going to happen when we do the will of God, like what happened to Christ? When he obeyed his Father, what was the result? He was persecuted. He suffered for righteousness' sake. And what's going to happen to us when we follow Christ? Are we going to have an easy life? No. We remember 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, "Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution." We're all going to partake of those sufferings for righteousness' sake when we follow Christ, which are the steps that he left us to walk in 1 Peter 2:21. And he says this is grace with God. That's the word charis that he uses there in 1 Peter 2:19 and 20. Translates it acceptable thankworthy. But that's the word that's there. It's the word for favor. How do we gain that there? What is grace with God? That's for us to do well, suffer for it, and then take that patiently, endure it, continue to do the will of God, not do evil to the ones that do evil to us, and not quit serving God and doing his will because we're having to suffer for that. And if we're willing to do his will, not our own, and do all of that through suffering for it, he says that is grace, that is favor with God. So that's displaying that humility, just as Christ did, walking in his steps. So we see this continued further now in James 4, verse 7 that we want to look at. Let's read 7 and 8 together. "Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded." Well, this is the encouragement, this is the exhortation to God's children that are caught up in these things that they shouldn't, and in any aspect of our own lives as we examine ourselves and we see things that we're not doing the way the Lord would have us to do that. What do we do about that? I think I've already told you many times, that's what my dad, that was what always ended, that was the final part of any lecture. So when I got in trouble, he would work his way to the point to where when I surrendered and said, yeah, that wasn't good. The final thing, his question would be, well, what are you going to do about it? Which is really the point. I mean, we need to see where we've not been doing right. But if all we do is see that, and there we are looking in the mirror again, like he teaches us in chapter 1 of the book of James. But if we go off and forget what we just saw and don't do anything about it, then what good is that? So what do we need to do? Well, we need to look in that mirror and see these brethren needed to look in their mirrors and see these problems they had and then do something about it. And that's what he's teaching us to do right here. He says, submit yourselves, therefore, since he gives it, resist the proud and gives his grace to the humble, then what do we have to do? Humble ourselves. So he says, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. That particular word submit that he uses there in James 4, verse 7, hupotasso, we mentioned that last week because it has... a part of the same word that's used in verse 6 where God resists the proud, that's antitasso, so this is hupotasso. As we had pointed out, that word tasso means to arrange in an orderly manner. When anti, the prefix anti is put in front of it, So then that means to range oneself against. That's opposing someone. That's the word resist that he uses in verse 6 that God does with the proud. Well, hupotasso, that is when we, and hupo is the prefix that means under. So we are to arrange ourselves in an orderly manner under, in this case, of course, God. And that's what the word means, to submit. So that's really showing the root or the etymology of the word. So we need to arrange ourselves under God and His authority. Well, we're going to be arranging ourselves under someone, one or the other, of two beings in terms of who we're going to have as our spiritual father. And as we have pointed out many times previously, if somebody is trying to take a position, well, I'm not submitting to anybody. I'm my own person, and I'm going to do my own thing, and not, well, so anybody that's saying that, they are arranging themselves under, they are submitting themselves in that case to whom? Is the devil okay with us going out and boastfully proclaiming that we're going to be a free agent and follow no one or anything and do our own thing? Well, yeah, because then whose will are we doing then? That's His will. So that's one of the ways that He can deceive somebody, and they can feel like or brag about not following anything or anybody. But we are. We're following someone. We're either following God or we're following the devil. I mean, that those are the only two options. And we're going to be either God's child or we're going to be a child of the devil. I know we've looked at 1 John 3:10 a lot of times, but we can go back there because it fits very well with what we're seeing here in James 4, verses 7 and 8. 1 John 3, verse 10 says, "In this the children of God are manifest." That's revealed. "And the children of the devil." So here's a verse that says, this is what reveals who is God's child and the devil's child. Now that's one of those verses that if we haven't memorized the reference by heart, we need to certainly know the words and the teachings of it. It'd be a good one to know the reference. In this, the children of God are manifest and the children of the devil. Now doesn't that grab our attention? In what? Well, he says, "Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother." So that's approached from the negative side, which is what makes one a child of the devil. Someone is not who is not doing righteousness. What is that? "Whosoever doeth not righteousness." What is righteousness? It's right doing. So whoever is not doing right, I mean, that's what that means. If you're not doing right and you don't love your brother, then whose child are you? Then you're a child of the devil. What's the flip side of that? The opposite. To be God's child, what do we have to do? We have to do what's right. And we have to love our brother. I mean, and how much of doing what's right is loving our brother? Well, enough that what did Jesus identify as the second greatest commandment in the law that all the others hang upon, along with first loving God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength? That's right. And then Jesus, of course, raised that standard to the new commandment in John 13, 34, and 35, which is to love one another as He has loved us. Well, that's His new commandment. And if we love God, we're going to do that. Because 1 John 4 also says, "How can you love God whom you've not seen if we don't love our brother whom we have seen?" And the answer is we can't. A major part of our doing what's right, doing righteousness, is going to be involved with our loving one another. And so if we don't do that, if we're not doing righteousness, if we're not doing what's right, in what? And who says what's right? I mean, these are fundamental questions, but the answer is God does. God's the one that tells us what's right and what's not. Is it up to me to decide that for myself or for anybody else, or you for you and anybody else? I mean, do we all get to decide what's right for ourselves? Is that something that God has, a privilege that God has granted to mankind, to decide that for himself? Jeremiah 10:23, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself, it is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. Is it up to us to decide what is right and wrong and do whatever we feel like doing ourselves? Not at all. God made us and we belong to him, and God has shown us what it is that we need to do and how we need to live on this earth. He's given us all things that pertain to life and godliness, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. Everything that we need to know to live right on this earth has been taught to us by God who made us. And he's the only standard. It's our job, of course, to then go and learn what that is. But in Romans chapter 1, 16 and 17, what he says about the gospel of Christ, Romans chapter 1, 16 and 17, for I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So there's a plain statement about where righteousness is revealed. It's in the gospel of Christ. This is our authority, the New Testament, the gospel of Christ, the law of Christ. This is the authority that we have been given to follow, to submit to. So that's where the righteousness of God is revealed. So he says, if we do not do righteousness, then we are not his child, but that of the devil. Well, that means to not do right means you're not doing what? Not following the teachings of the gospel of Christ, the New Testament. So that's where the authority is found. That's where we find what is right and what is not. And then we need to turn our feet to do what he says to do. And if we don't do that, and particularly if we don't love our brother, then we're the devil's child, not God's. But what other option is there? There's not one. The option is to either submit to God and do what's right and love one another as he's taught us to, or to not. And there's no middle way, third, fourth, fifth way, and there's no other way to, or no other child or spiritual father that we can be a child of. It's going to be one or the other, which is exactly what we're seeing here in James 4. In verses 7 and 8. So since God is the one that resists the proud and gives his grace to the humble, what should we do? Submit yourselves, therefore, unto God. So that's the conclusion of that. To arrange ourselves under God means then we're going to do what he says to do. Are we in subjection or submitting to God if we're not doing what he says? No. So we have to do what he says. And that's why we see submit or subjection and obedience. Those two go together, and we see it in the scriptures time and time and time again, where he'll use both those words in teaching us what we need to do in following God. Now, the authority of God that he has given to us, as it is translated into our practical living. Does God express his authority over us in different ways on this earth? Now, the teachings of the gospel, that's the standard. That's the one and only standard. But by that standard, does the Lord show us that he exercises his authority over us in various ways? Yes. The moment we're born into this world, well, we've been made by God. We're born into this world, and at that instant, we're born into a family, aren't we? So we have parents. And so what is our first introduction to the authority of God? Through the authority of our parents. So that's why over and over again, what does he teach children to do? I mean, this was part of the Ten Commandments for honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the earth. So this is, and that's why he calls it the first commandment with promise. But children are commanded to be in subjection to their parents. Jesus was to his in Luke chapter 2, verse 51. And he uses the very same word, hupotasso, submit. Here it's subjection. It's translated in Luke 2:51, but it's what Christ did when he was on this earth. Speaking of Jesus here, it says, and this is when he was 12 years old, it says, and he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject unto them. But his mother kept all these sayings in her heart. So he was the Son of God, but his father who sent him into this world had him born of Mary, and then he was brought up in a family with Joseph and Mary, and he was subject to his parents. So did he have to submit to the authority of his father through those earthly parents when he was growing up? He did, and that's what he did. He was submitting to God by doing that. Well, what are children doing when they obey their parents if they're doing so properly and for the right reason? Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 through 3 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord. For this is right, honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee and that thou mayest live long on the earth." So there's a commandment for children to obey their parents. Well, Jesus was in subjection. He submitted to his parents. The children are to obey their parents, it says, in the Lord. So when a child is taught properly, a child that's obeying their father and mother, they're doing so as a means of submitting ultimately to whom? And obeying God. I mean, if a child is only submitting to their parents because their parents are bigger and stronger, eventually one day that reason goes away, doesn't it? If the only reason they're doing it is because they're physically made to. I mean, is that the right reason? No. That will come to an end, and so will the submission if that's the reason. And it's not for the parents' own sake. Do you have your hand up there, Jan? Okay. I thought I saw something out of the corner of my eye. But anyway, the children, if they're doing so properly, of course, they're going to obey their parents in the Lord. It's going to be as a means of doing God's will. So if we love God, then if God says, obey your parents, then we do so. Now, the obedience part of that, as we know, Eventually, we reach a point as we grow up, and then we have our own family. And that's when he says to leave father, mother, and cleave to your wife. And so at that point, one is no longer under the direct authority of their parents. We grow up, and then we have our own family. And so then we have children that have to obey us. But as it pertains to our parents, so even though when we're no longer in the house and we're no longer under that direct authority anymore, what remains? What is that commandment in Ephesians 6:2? Honor your father and mother. Does that stop? Well, it better not. That was a problem Jesus dealt with. Jews had that, the Pharisees had that tradition, that Corban, they could give a sum of money, basically buy themselves out of having to do anything more for their parents. Here, I've given this gift, and then they wouldn't have to do anything more for their parents. Well, what did Jesus say about that? He says, you transgress God's commandment by your tradition, because doing that is then removing the obligation to honor one's father and mother. And when our parents get older, and if they need our help, what should we do? What did they do for us when we couldn't do anything for ourselves? And aren't we thankful they did it? Well, do we requite our parents? That's the principle in 1 Timothy 5 of why Christians should, in a family, should take care of the widows and their family. That's how you requite. That's how you pay back and treat the ones who took care of you. So that obligation to honor the parents never goes away. So we have to do that all of our days. But this, when we're born into this world, we have that part of God's authority that is over us through the parents. And there are many other aspects of that. In our jobs, the laws of the land. So from the family structure to civil society, the rules that we have to follow in our jobs. And in all of those things, the Lord over and over again uses that same word, the Greek word hupotasso, for submit. We have to submit to the authority that God puts over us and do it for His sake. So that's part of our duty. And so when he says, submit yourselves therefore unto God, well, how do we do that? Well, in all the ways that we have authority over us in this life, God's the one that has put that there, because who has all authority? Remember Matthew 28:18, Jesus said, all authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth. Philippians 2:9 says he's been given a name and authority which is above every name, above all authority. So is there any authority any legitimate authority that exists that isn't possessed by Christ? The answer is no. So in every way we have authority over us in this life, it's a manifestation of the Lord's authority over us. And if we love Him and are submitting to Him, we're going to submit to Him in all of those things. And that's what He teaches us to do. So the commandment in James chapter 4 and verse 7 is submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Well, that is opposed to following the devil. So we have to choose whom we're going to submit to, whose child we're going to be. And if we're going to submit to God, then we're going to have to do what He teaches us to do, what He commands us to do. Which then also means, what do we have to do concerning the devil? And this is why we see these two things together. So James 4 verse 7 says for us to submit ourselves to God. And concerning the devil, he says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God and he will draw nigh to you. So we can't be a friend of both. We can't serve both. We can't be a child of both. We have to make a choice. But when we submit ourselves to God, then we have the job to do to resist the devil. Now, this is a different word, resist, than what it was used in verse 6 when he said that God resists the proud. This word, resist, remember in verse 6, it was antitasso. Well, this is antithisteme. It means to stand against. So very similar, just like, well, there's a reason why it's translated the same. We have resist in English as the translation of both of those words. I mean, they're very close. But literally, this word in verse 7 means to stand against. Well, we need to stand against the devil. Well, if you're standing against someone, are you resisting? Yes. And that's why it's translated that way most of the time. Sometimes it's translated withstand. The point that we want to look at where we need to have some discernment, Matthew chapter 5, verse 39, if we can go over there for a moment. Well, we're going to see this word used in verse 39, but let's look at the context of it so we can seek to understand what he's teaching us there. Matthew chapter 5. Let's start in verse 38. You've heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. All right, this is the part of the Sermon on the Mount where he's making contrast between what they've heard, what they've been taught, with what he's teaching. Now, did Jesus tell them to, at any time, did he teach anyone to not obey what the law of Moses taught them? No. He fulfilled all of it, but what he taught, the new and everlasting covenant that he was bringing in, is of a much higher standard, and that's what we're seeing here. But where did they hear an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? Well, that was the Old Testament law. Is that the New Testament law? Are we under an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth now? No, we're not. That New Testament doesn't teach that. Here's what Jesus teaches, verse 39, but I say unto you that you resist not evil. Now that's that same word there, translated resist, that was in James 4, verse 7. So James 4, 7 says resist the devil. This says resist not evil. Does that make us confused a little bit? I hope not. But we do want to be able to make the discernment. When he says, but I say unto you that resist not evil, is he saying, I say unto you, don't resist the devil? No. We are to stand against, we are to resist, withstand the devil. But in what way is he saying, what does he mean when he says, don't resist evil? Well, the ones that serve the devil and bring persecution against us, they are the tools in the devil's hand to do evil to us. And there are going to be lots of people that do very evil things against us in our lives. And particularly when we are serving Christ, we're going to have things happen to us for that reason. Well, what do we do to the ones who do that? And that's the subject here. He says that you resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. And that was back in the time where one of the Roman, they were occupied by the Romans, of course, and a Roman soldier could compel anyone to carry their burden for a mile. Well, if they did that, if a soldier says, hey, you carry my load for a mile. Well, by the law, they had to do it. But what did Jesus say? If they do that to you, go too. So he's talking about the response, the way we respond to ones who are doing things to us. And so if somebody's hitting us, well, whose will are they doing? If somebody pops us in the jaw, I mean, whose will are they doing? I mean, they're doing the devil's will. So what's the proper response? Pop them back so they learn not to ever do that again? I mean, that's not what he tells us to do as Christians. That would be resisting evil, that person. In actuality, if we resist evil in that way, then we're not resisting the devil. Correct? Because the what's the command of God to do concerning those who do evil to us? To return good for evil. That's what he goes on to teach down to the end of the chapter. If we only love the ones who love us, how are we different than anybody else? How are we different than the world if we love people? If we're nice to people who are nice to us and we love people who love us? I mean, most people aren't crummy enough where somebody's nice to them and they're going to do something bad to them when they've done something good to them. Most people, if somebody does something good for them, they'll appreciate that and they'll do something good for them. They'll love people who love them. Well, that's what Jesus is showing us here at the end of the chapter. Verse 43, you've heard that it's been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy, but I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Why? Verse 45, going back to what we also saw in 1 John 3:10, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. What do we have to do to be God's child? What do we see in 1 John 3:10? Do righteousness and love our brother. Well, what is part of doing righteousness? Is this part of doing what's right that God teaches us? To love our enemies. So loving one another is a major part of our doing what's right, but so is loving our enemies. So if we don't love our enemies, are we doing what's right in the sight of God? If we do evil to people who do evil to us, can we be a child of God? Well, then we're not doing right, so we can't. So he says, do this that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. Well, right now we have, 7 billion people in change. Caleb, how many? India's got like 1.3 now? Yeah, so if you never realized that, one out of every 6 human beings on earth is in India. To put that in a little bit of perspective, and another 1/6 in China. So if you take China and India together, you got a third of all that live on earth just in those two countries. But anyway, 7 billion people and change we have in this world today. How many people in this world are truly submitting to God and living for Him and doing His will? Not many. And so does he only do good to, and when he's talking about the sun and the rain, what does that do? What does, for all you non-agriculture people in here like me, I mean, what we still should know. Dave knows real well. He plants those peppers and stuff, but if there's no sunshine and no rain, those things don't grow. Nothing does. So he's using that, of course, to as an example of what God provides to feed us. I mean, how many people is God feeding every day? He's feeding the whole world. And how many people is He feeding a day that are in rebellion against Him, thereby making themselves His enemies? He's feeding His enemies, and billions of them, day by day. Not only that, of course, most especially, what did He do for every one of us? Not when we were godly, but when we were in our sins. He gave His own Son. Did He do that as something for us, for doing good to Him? Or did He do that for us when we were His enemies? I mean, He gave His own Son for us. So how much does God do for everybody? So if we're going to follow God's example, I mean, God does good to the ones who are doing evil to Him. That's what He's giving as the example here. And He says, for if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. That word meaning complete, context there being love, God's love. And how are we to be complete in his love? What part of his love is he teaching us to make sure that we have there in Matthew 5? A love for our enemies. And we don't have his love complete in us if we don't do that. So that's, if we don't love our enemies and do good to them, then we are, and we do evil to them, then we are resisting them, which means then we are falling to the devil's temptation, and we're not resisting the devil. So if we resist the devil, if we resist the temptation to do evil to people that do evil to us, and we do good to and love them, then we're resisting the devil. So we need to make that discernment and have that understanding there, that resisting part. So resisting the devil is to not fall to any of the things that he is tempting us or enticing us to do, the devil's using these wicked people to do evil things to us. Does he care if we smack them around? Does he tell us, well, no, don't hit one of my servants? No, he's very happy with us to do something really bad to one of his own servants, because then that makes us one of his servants too. Does he love his servants? No. He's trying to destroy us all. So he doesn't care about those things. What he cares about is to make sure that we do what, not do God's will, but do the opposite. So we need to resist the devil. And that means in whatever way the devil is enticing us to not do what's right, we need to resist that and not fall to it. In the context of James 4, what we've seen with these brethren, the wars and fightings that were among them, as he put it there in the first verse, and those evil desires they were having, and a love for the world and evil things. What do we have to do with all of that? We've got to put that away. We have to resist the devil when he's enticing us to do those things. So he says, resist the devil. Now, when we do, what is the devil going to do? If we resist him, he's going to run. And that's what that word is. He will run from us. Now, is that... does God say that might happen, or does God say that will happen if we resist him? He says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. So that will happen. That's one of those promises that God does give to us. What happened with Jesus, Matthew chapter 4, we have that account of when Jesus was out in the wilderness for 40 days, tempted of the devil. And there's a description of those temptations. And then what did Jesus do with every one of them? He resisted the devil. How? What did he say every time? How did Jesus resist the devil in Matthew 4, 1 through 10? He used the word of God. That was his shield of faith. That was the armor he put on. And so that was reflected in each one of those cases. He said, it is written. So he used the scriptures. He used God's word to resist the devil. And when he did that in Matthew 4 verse 11, what was the end result afterwards? Then the devil leaveth him, and behold, angels came and ministered unto him. So when Jesus resisted the devil, what did the devil do? Devil left him. Does that mean he's going to leave us forever? No. We would that it were so, except that it's not God's will. But is there going to be, is God going to give us some rest from the temptations when the devil has obtained God's permission to put us through something with a lot of temptation? If we submit to God through all of that, humble ourselves before him, continue to do his will, resist the devil and not fall to his temptations for us to quit or strike out in evil against others that are doing evil to us, if we continue to obey all those commandments of God through that, is the Lord going to, is He going to give us a rest from that temptation for a time? That's what He's promising to do. Now, is the devil going to come back? Yes, it's going to be God's will that we have our faith tried some more. We grow, we hear more of God's word. We're going to grow more in our understanding and faith. And then that faith has to be tested. And so the devil's going to be back. But what do we know? Every time that we deal with temptation and we overcome it, the devil's going to run from us. And we'll have that opportunity to gain that strength and what we need to do to be ready for the next round. And there'll be many more rounds, but the Lord is, this is part of the Lord's work with us, and I know we've looked at it many times, but 1 Corinthians chapter 10, this is a demonstration of the faithfulness of God and His love for us and the way that He works with us. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man." Now, many times we might feel like that's not the case, but He's assuring us it is. This has never happened to anybody. Now, we can start feeling sorry for ourselves when we're under the gun, but the Lord assures us there's not some unique thing that the devil has carved out, especially for any one of us. These temptations are common to us all. He says, "But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it." And does He also know that we're not going to be able to bear unrelenting, continuous temptation, moment by moment, where there's no let up and that there's no break from or no rest from at all? We wouldn't be able to handle that. But God knows what we can handle. And so He says when we resist the devil will run from us. So we'll have that opportunity to gain the strength and be ready for the next battle. And God's going to be faithful through all of that. We're never going to be facing anything that we can't bear. And He knows exactly what we can. It's our job. He's giving us the responsibility to resist the devil. So that he will flee from us. And as part of that, verse 8 says, "Draw nigh to God, and He will draw nigh to you." This needs to be what we're doing in our lives. Continually drawing nearer and nearer and nearer to God, resisting the devil more and more and more, and submitting ourselves to God. Can we draw near to God if we're not submitting to Him? Humbling ourselves under Him. I mean, that's going to be, as we can see in these teachings, that's going to be part and parcel of that. So we need to submit ourselves to God and draw near to Him. Well, if we're seeking to draw near to God, and He says He'll draw near to us if we're doing that, what are some ways that we can do that? And this is just some thought as we're just about out of time here tonight. But if we're drawing near to God, what are some of the things that we're going to be doing? Doing what? Yes, which is the next thing He's going to say in the second half of verse 8. But what's that going to require? And to be able to do that, where do we find out how to do all that? I mean, if we're drawing near to God, are we going to be in His Word? We're going to be. I mean, how can we be drawing near to God if we're a stranger to the Scriptures? That's not going to go together. So, how much do we need to be seeking to know and understand the will of God by studying His Word? We need to be doing that more and more. I mean, how can we be drawing near to God if we're not doing that more and more? And we need to be doing that. What's something else we're going to be doing if we're drawing near to God? We're going to be studying His Word more and more diligently. And also, what are we also going to do without ceasing if we're drawing near to Him? We're going to be praying to Him. And those are some of the things that go by the wayside as a person is drifting away from God. They're going to be studying His Word less. They're going to be praying to Him less. When we're trying to draw near to God, those are things we're going to be doing more and more. We're going to have our minds on Him and on those things, and so we're going to be seeking Him more in those ways. So those are some of the things that we can do on a practical level as part of that drawing near to Him, because how are we going to cleanse our hands and purify our hearts if we don't know what we need to be purging out? And how are we going to find that except in His Word? So all of this is going to go back to what we saw in chapter 1 here in the book of James, that being hearers of the Word and doers of it. But we got to hear it, so we got to go to it and study it. And then we need to pray to God for what we lack. We need to ask of Him. And that's a big part of that, not being double-minded, is asking Him and not doubting Him. All right, well, we're out of time for tonight, so Lord willing, we'll continue in verse 8 next Wednesday night.